Naples is the one city in Italy, perhaps in all Europe, that should never be a... To do so means disappointment to those who have heard of Bela Napoli and the view which caused the Italians to describe it. Incantevole. From ashore, one receives the worst impression first, that of gaudy colors, of noise, of dirt, and the strident voices of people, far too many people. These scenes were taken mostly in the Vomero section, one of the better areas, but are typical of the entire city. On the other hand, at the sea approach is an experience never to be forgotten. Here is revealed the amazing combination of the very old and the very modern, which is Naples. From aboard ship, one enters this beautiful harbor through gem-like islands rising from a sparkling blue sea. One sees, after a first open-mouthed view of Vesuvius, the amazing harmony of curved coastlines, the sweep of the many gulfs, the jutting peninsulas and promontories, the villas spilling over the side of the heights of the Posilipo, and as far as the eye can see, the little towns like gardens perched along the sea, Portici, Resina, Torri del Greco, Castellamare, and Sorrento. We will make the trip to Sorrento later and never forget the haunting strains of Come Ye Back to Sorrento. There is a fascination about the bay that brings one back again and again with camera in your hand. Vesuvius makes such a perfect backdrop, towering sleepily over the entire area, glowering and smoking a little just to prove he can. Vesuvio resembles those meek old lions who are born in the zoo and spend their lives there. They couldn't earn an honest living being a lion for anything in the world. They just look the part. Vesuvius knows he plays an ornamental part in the landscape of Bela Napoli, a leading part without which the bay would lose its perfection and all Campania its reference point. So he smokes away proudly in the opal sky. And no matter where you stand with your family to have a picture made, with Naples Bay as a background, old Vesuvio sneaks into the picture somehow. Like most newcomers to Naples, we found that we couldn't tear ourselves away from this panorama in Cantevole, and after a couple of very expensive months in a hotel, we moved temporarily into the apartment of some American friends who were away. Our next-door neighbor was Admiral Kearney, who was Commander-in-Chief of Allied Forces of Southern Europe. His villa, shown here, built on the circular foundation, afforded a view which cannot be equaled anywhere. It It was a view that brought us out on our terrace early in the morning to watch the sun rise over Vesuvius and to see the smoky, sleeping city come to boisterous, brawling life. And to follow the fishermen's boats far down below on the pellucid waters as they put out from Santa Lucia. Finally, our villa in the country was ready for us, and we could move in. We didn't get a whole villa. Most people don't in Italy anymore. We got half of the ground floor and a small part of the garden in the rear. This is Villa Pagliano at 22 Via Zuppetta in Bella Vista. It doesn't look like much from here, but we paid dearly for the privilege of living in it. $165 a month, unfurnished to be exact, which in Italy means no light fixtures, no light meters, no gas meters, no nothing. The fact that the Italian family who rented the wing across from us were paying $20 a month didn't seem incongruous at all to the Italians in the Navy Housing Office, who were supposedly helping us Americans find quarters at a reasonable price. The fact that this place was bombed 7 times during the war may have had something to do with its rather beat-down appearance. Then, too, it doesn't pay to look too prosperous in Italy, or someone may expect you to pay taxes, or might even accuse you of being an American. Anyway, it was good to be able to escape some of the heat of the city, although there aren't many places in Italy where you can escape from the noise. And to be able to wake up in the morning and speak a friendly buongiorno to Vesuvius, who peeked in our bedroom window like this. That bedroom opened out on this cobblestone street down which carts with iron tires and 10,000 steel-footed horses passed at all hours of the day and night. The vendors of vegetables, milk, charcoal, oil, dishes, coat hangers, and so on were not modest about bragging about their wares in a rich Neapolitan dialect. This is a festa, a religious celebration, that has just paraded by. At 2 a.m. that Sunday morning, we were brought screaming from our beds by the doggonedest assortment of fireworks you ever felt shaking the house. The church of this particular saint was half a block away, and he kept me awake for 2 hours, during which time enough money was burned up in fireworks to have bought a pair of shoes for every barefoot child in the village. Our furniture came in some 20 huge crates on one of the biggest trucks and trailers I ever saw. Our Steinway piano, being German, took a dislike to one of the Italians who moved us in and fell on him. But after much screaming and what I took to be appropriate Neapolitan curses, our landlord took over. Conte Giuseppe Pagliano, a real count and a former general in the Italian Air Force, had him carried into the courtyard, plied with something alcoholic, and allowed him the ineffable pleasure of lying on one of our rugs and encouraging his fellows to do a good job for the rest of the afternoon. These are some of my sailors who offered to come home with me and salvage the lumber in the packing cases out of which we made all sorts of shelving and such. Our son Bill, getting in the spirit of things, furnished the music for the occasion on his fisarmonica. The privilege of using this sidewalk was explicitly given us in the terms of our lease, and the fruit and our portion of the yard were also ours. We were more fortunate than many American families who had been helped by our housing office friends to find apartments in downtown Naples. We could at least get away from the crowd in our yard, but never away from Vesuvius, who looked in on us perpetually and shared our joys and our sorrows. When I acquired this Lambretta motor scooter and a beret, I could go anywhere in Naples with my wife riding the rear seat side saddle with a shopping basket hanging from the handlebars and pass for a Neapolitan couple. That meant we could buy fruits and vegetables at the regular price instead of the American price. In Naples, more than anywhere else in Italy, the spirit of the city is found in the street scene. For these people to be out of doors is the most precious thing in existence, even if the outdoors is only a tiny balcony hung high over the noisy street below. They even bring the outdoors indoors in great gallerias such as the Galleria Umberto. The colorful posters and decorated carts and general air of studied disorder, the violent and dramatic arguments between people who will at any moment turn and ask the audience they're always sure of if they don't agree with them, the strange vocalizations of the street vendors who can pile cauliflower on a cart in such a way as to make the whole affair look like one great big flower, or who will lure unsuspecting donkeys into strange assignments. The patter of little feet, which may be a Sicilian asino piccolo carrying two husky contadini who enjoy the prospect of being memorialized by a photograph. The Neapolitan boy who carries on a Sicilian tradition of decorating his cart and who dresses his horse for some religious festival while he self-consciously holds his homemade cigarette, which he hopes soon to trade for an American cigarette. "E Gio, cigarette," is the constant cry. The old fellow who plods his way on his donkey cart in the gathering dusk, singing Amore, Amore. Is this all a stage and the people players? Naples is a theater of startling contrasts, if theater it is. The hovel side by side with the princely palace, a modern apartment building with plate glass doors and inlaid tile lobby next door to a family living in a cave. Spacious promenades along the bay, such as Via Caracciolo, more beautiful than any I have ever seen anywhere, with maids pushing baby carriages of the very rich that would cost a year's wage of the man who lives in the narrow street that descends the slopes of the Vomero, dark and slippery lively with noise, redolent of the savory smell of squash blossoms fried in oil, of octopus in a piquant sauce, pasta fagioli or pizza, and other smells not so pleasant. Everybody hurries, jostles, laughs, or sings, executing in his own way the extravagant, confusing, and discordant ballet that is Naples. New buildings such as this post office, built under Mussolini, share the sun with very old castles and churches, amidst mobile public address systems and horns, and the plaintive bagpipes of shepherds come into town for the Easter season. Even the beggar, with his wheezy accordion, doesn't bother to play a tune. He just expresses himself with great gusto and a lot of noise. The real Naples is between the great buildings, where streets seem like narrow gorges filled with an uproar that is not human in origin. There is an arousing cloud of dust and smell and noise expressing unquenchable gaiety. Unquenchable because to be gay at all in such a locale is a miracle in itself. Naples is alive, all right, with a blatant, cockeyed, devil-take-the-hindmost air, and it was built just that way. If you have the price, you can sit under a terrace of wisteria and listen to the philosophy of a waiter who takes his profession and his tip very seriously, or when your command of Italian runs out, you can just sit and look out over the city, wonder why so many people have to live in so little space. At least you can understand the famed expression, "See Naples and die," for nothing could be more striking in its contrast of extreme beauty and extreme ugliness, its fine artistic sense and its gross brutality, its obvious wealth and its equally obvious and much more prevalent poverty. Truly, when you've seen Naples, you've seen it all. The curve of the coastline south from Naples, beyond Pompeii, draws the eye to its farthest point, where in close communion with the Isle of Capri is the town of Sorrento. Sorrento is a garden, a fairyland of orange and lemon groves, blue, blue sea, and fair skies. This is truly Italy at her best. It seems, in fact, that the best and most exquisite that nature could create is assembled here for the delight of all the senses. It is a heroic landscape where towns and villages nestle in the hollow of peaceful bays. Its very curves are a music adorned by fairy gardens, endowed with a luxurious and almost tropical vegetation. No wonder you can find fishermen along this coast who will swear that this is the place where mermaids still sun themselves on the rocks below. We were drawn to visit Sorrento by the call of the mermaids even before our car arrived. So we rented a Fiat Topolino, and having watched Italian families do it, we managed to get all four children aboard. And after a short period of panic, wondering what to do about reverse gear, which I couldn't find, we left Naples behind and started out the autostrada, the toll road to Pompeii and Sorrento. And the sun top on the Topolino made it convenient for us to poke our heads out and absorb the clear, clean atmosphere of the countryside as we passed the famous vineyards on the slope of Vesuvius. The jewel-like island of Capri followed us as we hugged the semicircular coastline, stopping every now and then to admire ourselves in this novel setting. I do not think there is anywhere on earth such an accumulation of beautiful scenery in so small an area. Each secluded cove, each new view of Capri or Vesuvius, each new cliff with the clear water breaking over the rocks far below. This is the country where Pliny the Elder lived, and it was immediately resettled after the great eruption of 79 AD, unlike Pompeii and other spots. The Angevin kings built their villas in magnificent gardens of pomegranate, fig, and orange trees on the very site of villas where long ago the old Romans lived and played and enjoyed the same beauty. We saw the Sola dei Galli, the Mermaid Isle. And on a later trip, we saw at Massalubrense, not far from Sorrento, a temple dedicated to the mermaids, by the side of which is a church, supposedly Christian, where the rites and festas are the same as those which were the festivals of the mermaids, but are now labeled in honor of Santa Maria della Lobra. We went back to Sorrento many times and felt it was good to escape to the cleanliness and beauty after the hectic life of Naples. One of our favorite occupations was trying to guess what former king or famous writer or artist or international financier lived in the beautiful villas set in the bays and coves overlooking Capri, or in admiring the latticework of terraces of covered orange and lemon groves protected by these coverings. The woven covers made possible a longer season for fruit and certainly did nothing to impair their flavor, for nowhere outside of Florida have we ever had better fruit. But then, what orange wouldn't be sweet grown in such beautiful surroundings? The road on past Sorrento finally runs into this tiny square and then becomes nothing more than footpaths running along the sea. The ancient barefoot woman trudging by is carrying a huge net, and she doesn't have time to wonder how an American Ford got in such a place, nor to worry how we were going to traverse the narrow winding road out of there. We made it and went back again. This time we climbed to the top of the Sant'Angelo mountain group, the backbone of the Sorrento Peninsula. And on top we discovered Agherola, a little town that was so much like a Swiss mountain village that we had to remind ourselves that this was still Italy. The road continues through that cleft in the mountains, and this is the view from that point. This is part of the well-famed Amalfi Drive, the rocky other side of the Sorrento Peninsula. Visitors, when they catch their breath, say, "But this is the Italy we imagined." The inhabitants have no time for such understatement. They just call it La Divina Costiera, the heavenly coast. caverns open in the rocks along the water? Are they natural grottos or pagan sanctuaries? Large umbrella-like pines cast their shadow against red and yellow rocks. The vine and olive and terraced citrus fruits cover the slopes of Positano and Praiano. Here man and nature have combined to create some of the most bizarre and grandiose scenery in the world. The road proceeds at considerable height along the precipitous rocky coast, threading in and out of bays and headlands, through tunnels and over ravines, twisting back on itself so often that car sickness is a hazard to be reckoned with. This trip would be worthwhile for its own sake. But at the halfway point, we come to Little Amalfi. Looking rather dizzily at this tiny town with its colorful tile roofs and gay cupolas, it is hard to imagine that in the Middle Ages, its population was 10 times that of today. And it was the rival of Genoa and Pisa for the mastery of the Mediterranean, with its independent republican form of government and its own code of maritime laws. But who would believe it today, reduced as it has been by earthquakes and landslides and the shifting sands of commercial prosperity? Today, in Amalfi, you fish or mend nets or sit in the sun. Passing through Amalfi after a rest and a good dinner of fresh fried shrimp and octopus, preceded by the usual antipasto and pasta, followed by the least alcoholic dessert you can pick, we drive on past Ravello, Atrani, Minore, Maiore, and Cetara. Now ahead, we can see Salerno, the end of the Amalfi Drive. You can return to Naples by cutting back to the left and going across the peninsula, coming out onto Naples Bay at Pompeii. Salerno was the scene of the Allied landings in 1943. But if anyone expected these hills to register surprise, he was doomed to disappointment. The Saracens landed here and left their marks. The Norman conquerors left watchtowers along the coast. Goths and Vandals had ranged up and down, looting and burning in their time. Yes, these hills have seen history. Jason and his Argonauts, going home with the Golden Fleece, sailed past these shores. Staying for a while on the far side of the bay, founded a temple to the goddess Hera. Before I lived in that country, I may have laughed at such a possibility, but after Paestum, we're prepared for anything. One has to be careful in the matter of legends entwined in European civilization. We still do not know if history is all tommy rot, but we're constantly being forced to admit that a lot of tommy rot is history. It all began when an archaeologist discovered there was not only a town named Troy, but 7 of them, one on top of the other. The Iliad has received more respectful treatment by historians since then. Then someone dug on the island of Crete and discovered that there had been a labyrinth there, just as the legend of Theseus had said. So, 2 Italian archaeologists looked for Jason's temple, and after years and years of search, they actually found it. Someone has called this the most important archaeological find of the century, and it is still being explored. We were present when vases and other articles manufactured by Jason's contemporaries of the 5th century before Christ were dug from the earth at Paestum. I don't think anyone is ever prepared for Paestum. Leaving Salerno, one passes through rather commonplace Italian farmlands, and then, incredibly enough, there it stands. No Acropolis, just a flat cornfield. No craggy coastal cliffs, but a smooth beach which welcomed the Allied invaders of 1943, with some lack of cooperation by the Germans. No descendants of the Sybarites are here. Malaria and countless waves of conquest from the north have obliterated them. But here stands incontrovertible proof that once this was Greece. Here are some of the world's best preserved Greek temples. These large moldering sandstones in the foreground were once the south wall of Poseidonia, founded by the Greek Sybarites 500 years before Christ. This was a city dedicated to pleasure, sensuous pleasure, the enjoyment of the moment. Those in the background are not Sybarites, nor the Lucanians who conquered them, nor Saracens, nor Normans who conquered the conquerors, nor Romans, but possibly the descendants of all of them. These are modern Italian laborers who ride to work on a bicycle carrying a lunch of bread and cheese and a bottle of wine, and who are now uncovering first the road on which we're standing, then vases and images bearing the fingerprints of other men who labored over 2,000 years ago in the same spot. So strangely mortal is pleasure that its signs are gone, but the signs of creative labor are everywhere. Perhaps the slaves and workmen who built could not share in the pleasures of the processions and music and sensuous rites held in these places. But could they stand where we are today? Would they too realize that men who seek only material comfort never gain immortal fame? Built at the same time as the Parthenon, but on foreign soil, these structures have all the refinements of the builder's skill. The famous curvature of the horizontals, the inclined corner columns, all the amazing architectural tricks of the Greek builders. Close by these temples, nearer the shoreline of the Mediterranean, lies the foundation of the temple to the goddess Hera, only recently uncovered. A discovery which causes men to reopen the pages of the Iliad and apologize to Jason and his crew. Thank you. 20 miles inland from Naples, on the opposite side of Vesuvius from Sorrento, with Paestum 80 miles to the south, there is a place almost as incongruous as the centuries-old Greek city. This is Caserta. Here in the middle of a fertile agricultural plain dotted with the usual crumbling villas containing hundreds of people, chickens and dogs backed up against the foothills of the Apennines, is one of the greatest architectural achievements of all time. Back in 1735, Charles of Bourbon, king of the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, son of the Spanish king who drove the Austrians out of Naples, confiscated all this land from some wealthy enemies and dreamed him a dream. He would build a palace here on this spot and make Caserta the rival of Versailles, which his ancestor Louis XIV had built. And he came very close to doing just that. Unfortunately, the palace was never completed. You can make out the six-story high palace with its 1,200 rooms, theater, chapel, four courtyards, and so on, in the distance behind my son, who is standing on top of the artificial waterfall. Van Vitelli, who designed the Vatican, was the architect, and one could spend weeks admiring the beautifully decorated rooms inside the palace. But the garden seen here, the many artificial lakes and waterfalls, the comparative solitude were what appealed to us. We're standing on top of a mountain 2 miles away from the palace. Out of a cave just underneath us, a large artificial river is flowing. Water brought 30 miles through tunnels and mountains, over roads and railroads by aqueducts of three tiers of arches built by Van Vitelli for this purpose. The water cascades down to this pool, from which it flows alternately underground over waterfalls and through pools to disappear underground just adjacent to the royal palace. Waterfalls are decorated with fanciful statuary, such as this portion of a hunting scene of Minerva and her maidens. At least I think that's who it is. The characters in the foreground are better known to me. Two of my boys strike up a bilingual acquaintance with a little Italian boy. Don't let the clothes fool you, he's a boy. And he reversed the usual procedure by giving the Americans some candy. One of the more colorful sights in the countryside around Naples is a group such as this carload of young girls on a festa of their own. The custom is to save up your money all year, make or buy dresses all alike, rent a car, the bigger the better, pack a lunch, and spend one glorious day traveling to the shrine of the saint that you're all named after. It's a combination picnic and pilgrimage, and what better place to spend the picnic part than in the royal gardens at Caserta? Pompeii left me cold. For some reason or other, I disliked Pompeii. Perhaps it was the insistence of the guides, or the fact that so much they insist on showing tourists is of a gross and immoral nature. I much preferred quiet little Herculaneum, which we shall visit later. The forum shown here is one of the better spots. Here was the heart of the city of Pompeii, surrounded by what must have been a beautiful portico, the temple of Apollo, which begins there on the right, a temple to Jupiter and other buildings. Pompeii is so large that one can wander all day along such streets as this, rutted by wagons, dotted with crossing stones which enable one to cross the street dry-shod in rainy weather. Evidently, Pompeian chariots did not succeed in acquiring the low, underslung look of modern American automobiles. The better homes of Pompeii boasted beautiful, formal gardens with pools and columns and mural paintings on all flat surfaces. This is one of the less pretentious of many such gardens which have been planted much as they were when used by the Pompeians. From Via Consolare, you can enter the Pistrinum, a bakery which had formerly been a home. The owners probably continued to live in the upper floor and turned their garden into a grist mill and equipped it with large ovens, and the ground floor into storage and stables and sales rooms. In the museum at Pompeii are many interesting artifacts, personal articles, and so on. This cast of a dog was made on the spot where he was left chained to die with his masters in the great eruption of 79 A.D., the eruption which Pliny the Younger described so vividly in his letters to Tacitus. Pompeii remained buried under 20 feet of lava and ashes until the 19th century. And actually, I wonder sometimes why they bothered to uncover it. Naples, you can see better ruins, save yourself a half a day at least, and a lot of money by taking what I call the trolley car tour. For less than 50 lire, you can hop a trolley in the heart of Naples at Piazza Municipio, ride through some of the most interesting parts of downtown Naples, past the Central Railroad Station, along the waterfront where Naples took such heavy bombing and shelling that 10 years later, people are still living in roofless ruins. Out Corso Garibaldi, where once a boulevard is now a cobblestone nightmare to automobiles. Our landlord was wounded here and lost an eye from naval gunfire. You pass through several communities with different names, but they all look like a continuation of Naples, until after you pass through Portici. This shot was made in the rain at Torre del Greco, and this scene could be duplicated in 1,000 places along the waterfront around Naples. Thank you. one of the waterfront towns, Resina, was only a couple of miles from our home in Bella Vista. It was built on top of the ancient city of Herculaneum, port city for Pompeii, and much wealthier, which was destroyed by the same eruption of Vesuvius. Herculaneum, however, was buried under silt from the bay and was much better preserved than Pompeii. The modern, I use that word carelessly, city of Resina is on the right, and it is obvious why more of Herculaneum has not been unearthed. Herculaneum was discovered before Pompeii, but since Pompeii was out in flat farmland, it could be excavated more easily. It took Mussolini to order the relocation of many families and provide for much of the area now uncovered. There's a different air about Herculaneum. Perhaps it's the ever-present consciousness of the present city above you. You can occasionally hear the sounds of a passing trolley or charcoal vendor and can look up to the dilapidated present. Or perhaps it's the remarkable state of preservation of these homes and baths and stores. Wooden doors, beautiful wooden cupboards are as well preserved as the marble statues. Here is one which has been left where it was found in the Casa dei Cervi, a beautifully carved deer being assaulted by hounds. One fully expects a figure in a toga to stroll into the room speaking Latin and dividing Gaul into three parts. This is the garden of the same house, showing in the background a table with richly carved legs. The Lady Marine had just arrived in Naples for duty with NATO, and my wife and I surprised her by speaking American. She thought I was a guide. Didn't I have a beret on? This is the atrium of a lovely home. The colors are just barely perceptible in this late evening shot of a patio that would do credit to any Florida or California style house. And a view of the bay that must have delighted the owner. The round medallions suspended between the columns contain carvings of satiric figures and theatrical masks. The white marble stands out beautifully against the red columns and walls. The fact that some of the most beautiful marble wall decorations ever found were unearthed in this house, and that some rooms still remain under Resina yet to be unexcavated, cause one to wish impatiently for another Mussolini to get it done. After a year living on the slopes of Vesuvius, 10 miles out the autostrada from my office, we decided we wanted a change. I'd become quite fond of my Lambretta motor scooter, and we looked for a place within scooting distance of my office. On the reverse side of the Posilipo, we located a place. I think it took our landlord, a northern Italian, to build the only house on the wrong side of the view of Naples Bay, because to a Neapolitan, it would be unimaginable to live with a hill blocking the view of Vesuvius. Around that curve on the upper right, you're in Naples, high up on the Posilipo, overlooking the million-dollar view. To the left, down via Michelangelo di Caravaggio Pitture, is Bagnoli, an industrial, communist-controlled town. Bagnoli lay far below us, and serene our little bit of countryside between two noisy cities. We could enjoy the fireworks of festas, the marching bands and soccer game crowds, and the lights of a huge fair, the Mostra d'Oltremare, far below. The sounds, a steady hum, but not too insistent, as we enjoyed our newfound privacy. looking out our bedroom window over the tops of our apricot trees, we could see the strait between the islands of Procida and Ischia in the distance, and the town of Pozzuoli, called Puteoli in the 28th chapter of the Book of Acts, which is located around the peninsula to the right. Had we stood here in the first century A.D., we could have seen a ship bearing the Apostle Paul as it put into Puteoli, where St. Paul spent a week with the Christians of the First Baptist Church of Puteoli before going on to Rome. Admiral Carney had his yacht at Naples and never got around to inviting us to use it. But we did have some Higgins boats in the boat pool, which we could use. I invited the high school girls and the men of the choir to make several trips to the island, Ischia and Capri. We would leave from the fleet landing here at the Stazione Marittima in the shadow of the Castel Nuovo, built by Charles I of Anjou. High up on the hill above is the Castel San Elmo, behind which, about half a block, was the Arcobaleno Theater, in which we had our Sunday school and church services. Just around the corner from the building on the right was the office building used by headquarters support activities, in which my office was located. We're off to Capri, or is it Ischia? The gray ship in the background to the right is the USS Adirondack, Admiral Carney's flagship, which remained tied up at the Stazione Marittima for almost the entire time we were in Naples, and it made the word that the Italians called it seem appropriate, Adirondack. This time it's the island of Ischia. We anchored the landing craft out from shore over the whitest sand bottom and the clearest water, which was shallow enough for the children to enjoy. Ischia doesn't have the sophisticated glamour of Capri, but to us, it offered a more friendly welcome. I understand the widow of Mussolini makes her home on Ischia, and I can understand why. Shiniest show place on the whole summer coast of Italy is the island of Capri. Once an emperor's playground, it is now a center for socialites, nobility, movie people, eccentrics, and vast hordes of tourists who jam aboard launches in Naples daily for the run to Capri. We had our own sightseeing tours using our Navy boats and would heave to just offshore from Gracie Field's swanky casino, La Canzone del Mare, and for free enjoy the expensive pleasures of the Isle of Enchantment. There is a tunnel in the middle rock through which we used to run our boats. Capri in season is undoubtedly one of the world's most pleasant places to be. Eating outdoors anywhere in Italy is always a pleasure. Here it's an art. The funicolare pulls up through tunnels of flowers from the harbor Marina Grande to the town of Capri in a saddle halfway up the cliff. Or if you tire of exquisite scenery, you will want to cruise around the island admiring the rocks and cliffs which resemble petrified giants, stopping by to enter some of the many waterline caves, such as the red grotto, green, yellow, pink, white grottos, or the more famous blue grotto shown here. picnicking, whether on a boat offshore or on the ruins of an old city, is one of our favorite occupations. And one of our favorite spots was Cuma. Here we are with Chaplain Roderick Smith of the USS Midway on the Acropolis of the ancient Greek city. In the center of the level mountain in the background, you can see a cut and a road running through the center of Monte Grillo. It is an arch of brick-faced concrete. This is the Arco Felice on the Via Domitiana. These cobblestones were laid by the Romans under Domitian, and this was the main route from the important port of Puteoli to Rome, a part of the Appian Way. Through these portals passed the Apostle Paul. The sight of the tall arch wedged between the high vine-clad tufa walls, a gigantic soaring construction upon which bushes of broom and small oak strike a fresh rural note against the red brick, the sudden appearance of the unmistakable Roman paving, and the view through the arch of the radiant open coast and the high ruins of Cuma make this one of the most poetic and memorable spots in the entire area. Actually two cities, or rather a city and an acropolis. It was founded by the Greeks about 800 years before Christ and was the leading city of all Campania for centuries. When the Romans took over, Puteoli became the more important city and Cuma became a sleepy, tranquil town. It became one of the earliest centers of the Christian movement. Here my children sit in a baptismal pool of what was a 5th or 6th century Christian church. They still remembered some of the New Testament practices of the early Christian church and baptized the right way, evidently. This had been originally a Greek temple, perhaps to Jupiter, and was converted into a Christian church later. From here toward Naples along the coast is a lovely one, and it is easy to see why a temple and a church should have been planted here. Does our picnic basket look out of place in these surroundings? How about four typically American faces? Groves, we were attracted most to the caves underneath the city. Actually, two sets of them, a veritable honeycomb of both Greek and Roman caverns. Those dug in trapezoid form through solid rock were the famous grottos of the Cumaean Sibyl. Running completely under the lower city, these caverns contained cisterns for ceremonial bathing by the oracle priestesses, huge vaulted temples underground, and even today, a feeling of the underworld. We explored many of these, feeling we were apt to run into almost any unearthly manifestation at any moment. In one, we stumbled upon a large underground sanctuary with a huge stone altar set in the center of the room. Directly overhead in the high stone ceiling, a small shaft had been drilled somehow to the upper world, and a tiny beam of light became visible, playing on the altar. You stand quietly for a moment, visualizing some of the things that might have taken place in this Stygian pit, and then find some excuse to go back out to the entrance for a while. The children were not the only ones who preferred the larger Roman cavern, which had occasional shafts for light. But even to stand well inside these and watch a group of black-robed monks enter and come toward you as these are doing here could give you a queer feeling. I think I whistle Dixie. For a real change of scenery involving a return to modern times as well, we can make the trip to the top of Monte Faito beyond Naples toward Sorrento. The town of Castellammare, a famous resort even in ancient times, is still that. But we avoid that city by taking a new highway which skirts above and hugs the base of Monte Faito. I was posing the children in front of this castle which overlooks Castellammare and the waters of Golfo di Napoli because I like castles. When the Funivia passed over, you can see the tiny speck above the small tower of the castle. It is a car which runs down from the top of Monte Faito to the heart of Castellammare, over 2,000 feet in 8 minutes. It will take us an hour to climb it in our car. But before we begin our climb, let's pose the children in front of the front door of the castle. The bougainvillea was reminiscent of Florida, but that was the only familiar note about such massive splendor. I wonder if a salesman ever put his foot in that gate. Let's begin the ascent of the mountain. About 20 minutes from the castle, we stop for a rest. Oh, for a little Topolino to navigate the bobby pin turns instead of our station wagon. The gray area in the center background is old Pompeii, new Pompeii, one of the most squalid of Italian cities, with a church containing some of the richest treasures of gold and silver and jewels in the world, is the white area to the right. Higher still, we enter forests of pines and chestnuts. I suddenly remember that I have read somewhere that most of the edible chestnuts in America are shipped over from Italy. The road is full of them, and we let the children run ahead of the car, picking them up and filling up the back seat with a tremendous pile of them. And so we reach the top of the mountain, and through the trees far below, we can see the shoreline of the Gulf. This is the car that was the tiny speck in the sky over the castle. This is the top of the world for this area, and this little Funivia is the link that connects one with the sober reality of the world below. So we walk out to a clear spot and just look. Even the architecture is different up here. The houses look like Switzerland. We realize that many very wealthy families have discovered Monte Faito for themselves and decided to stay. Cruising along the shady lanes underneath the chestnut trees, we wish we could think of an excuse to stay too. Then we finally find the place we've been looking for. For we could see this place from Bella Vista, probably even from Naples, if we could take our eyes off the traffic. We don't know whether it was war or time that had caused the damage, but suspected the war, since this spot would command the whole Naples area, the Gulf, the shipyards, the flat country around Naples, and even Naples itself. And this is the view from this spot. Mark is not impressed and throws rocks. Going down, I get an evening shot of Castellammare. From the water's edge, the sky reminds you that there is gold that moth and rust do not corrupt, nor can thieves break in and steal. and the lowliest contadino shares with emperors and with you and me. Most travelogues leave you at this point with the evening sun going down, but I would prefer to leave you with a shot I made early one morning from the apartment of some friends where we stayed high on the Posilipo when we first arrived at Napoli. The sun raises himself up over Vesuvius with his customary cloud blanket, and for a brief moment in the early morning haze, ancient castles and modernistic apartments, anchored men of war and primitive hand-hewn fishing boats, good and bad, rich and poor, share in a common, anonymous beauty. The city stretches, yawns, and begins the uproar almost immediately that is so typical of Naples. And the common factor disappears as rich and poor take their respective places, and the Neapolitan ballet resumes where it left off late the night before. We sit enchanted, learning again the meaning of the phrase, dolce fare niente. The poet Shelley put it this way: Naples, thou heart of men, which ever pantest naked beneath the lidless eye of heaven, Elysian city, which to calm enchantest the mutinous air and sea. Arrivederci.
la gente sera, gente la marina, Petrovana innamorata, San carozza graziana, para proprio speciala. Tiri tomba, nell'uvera le ore, tiri tomba, la reale. Tire tomba, 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 tire tomba